This is the ICANN Buenos Aires on 21st of November. The meeting room is Aguila. It's the Framework of Interpretation Working Group. And I would like to remind everybody to say your names before you speak for the transcript record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Christina. Is this working? Sounds like it. Okay. My name's Keith Davidson, for the record. I'm the chair of the working group. Just before we go around table for introductions, I'll just put in my own apology that from time to time today I'll probably be standing up and walking around because I've got a very bad knee and it locks up if I sit down for too long. So I think we have quite a light agenda today in spite of some last-minute changes that we can attend to during the agenda bashing session. But I don't think we're going to consume the entire 3 hours, so I think we'll having a break somewhere along the line and probably finishing early. But that's over to you individually. So can I have a list of apologies, please, Gabestina?
I don't have any apologies.
No apologies. Can we go round the table and...
I've seen Cheryl, who sends her apologies. She's going to be arriving late,
okay.
But she will be coming.
An apology from Cheryl Langdon, or for lateness. Can we go round the room and introduce ourselves, starting with Per?
Hi, I'm Per Donnell. I'm representing .mu.
Patricio Paulette from Nick Chile.
Gabriela Szczecek, CCNSL. Christina Nordstrom, CCNSL.
Frank March, representing New Zealand on the GAC.
Jim Davies, ICANN staff.
Nigel Roberts, .gg.
Bernie Turcotte. Staff support.
Becky Bird, .us.
Daniel Kaltuf, .bg.
Martin Boyle, .uk, nominate.
Bill Manning, .um.
Eva Adlisa, .na.
Thank you. So I'll assume that those present has been correctly recorded, as have the apologies. I see no exceptions. A bit of an agenda bash, if we could. Bill Manning fortuitously was in the room, and we had a bit of a discussion as we were coming together. Bill was the delegated representative for .um, and we did identify that as an oddity on our way through the delegation redelegation working group process. So just to take advantage of him being here and the fact that we have quite a light agenda, I'd like to introduce an additional item for just 10 minutes for Bill to take us through so that we might have a bit more colour and depth over that undelegation than was given to us via the ICANN board reports and so on. So if we could do that after we confirm the meeting notes, and then if we could spend a little bit of time with Frank as our GAC representative on this working group, and just look at the process for the CCNSO and GAC, and or this working group and GAC collaboration going forwards from here through to the end of our work, and just what we might be able to do with the GAC to ensure that we're walking in step together into the sunset. So if we could do that after Bill's, and then return to the agenda and to item four, which will be the responses to the public consultation and so on. So is everyone happy with that? Is there anything else to add to the agenda? I see one new person in the room. Can you please introduce yourself on the microphone for the record?
I'm Dan Jukic from .rs.
Thank you. Okay. If there's no further agenda bash, I'll just note for the record that Boswinkle has joined the room. And okay, and Bernie, we've had the meeting notes from the 7th of November. Is there anything from that that isn't otherwise covered on the agenda? Does anyone have any issues with that meeting report? No?
Yep. Nothing on my side. Fairly straightforward.
Excellent. Well, shall we move then into .um and Bill, the floor is yours.
Okay, so if the floor is mine, yes?
Some of us all know about .um, what it is, but many people won't. Do you mind starting from the very, very beginning of the dawn of time and giving 2 seconds on how it came about before you tell us how it came not to be about?
Okay. There was a volcanic eruption that occurred in the late 1980s when there was some discussion about increasing or changing the number of top-level domains from the 5 that existed at the time. And there was a decision made to use the ISO 3166 codes to create sovereign-level delegations on the assumption that most of those things were sovereigns. There were a few codes that were added in which were not from ISO 3166. But in general, that's referred to as the country code delegations. Ann Cooper, myself, Suzanne Wolf, and Steve Hotz, under the direction of John Postel, created all of the new TLDs under the CC list, including .un. At the time, most countries, there was not good connectivity. The internet did not spread globally. Countries had no internet in their mindset. It was below the event horizon for most of them. And so we ended up assigning operation of the country code top-level domains to technically adept parties, whether or not they were in the country or not. And this generated about 5 or 6 years later, when connectivity did occur towards the mid-1990s, end of 1990s, when countries actually started to figure out that this was important. There were a fair amount of redelegations that occurred. Perhaps the most interesting one for me was the government of China figured out that it wanted CN and discovered that CN was actually allocated to a couple of graduate students at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. And the difficulty there is that many branches of the Chinese government decided they wanted it. And so as part of the redelegation process, there was what Postel used was, is you go figure out what it is that you want and tell us. Give us a consistent answer, and then we will evaluate. That happened. UM never really had another home. I was the original administrator for UM. I'm sorry? UM is designated as the U.S. Minor Outlying Islands. It is 9 islands in the Pacific and 1 in the Caribbean. All of them are currently uninhabited. There was 1 island in the Pacific, Baker Island, that was used to extract guano. There are mineral rights listed. They're still there. Currently, those mineral rights are owned by DuPont. But they have an injunction against tapping natural resources in what is considered now a national park.
Just interrupting for a moment, I see some new people in the room. So for the record, could we have your names on the... if you could use the microphone and introduce yourselves.
Yes, my name is Chris Chimanga, the administrative contact of CityNIC.
Can't hear. You might have.
Okay. Cdnic.
Dot cd. Dot cd. And it's Chris.
Yes.
Thank you, Jim. And.
Jaap Akkerhuis, I'm from NL, from NLNet Labs, but for here I'm actually representing ICANN on the MA3166 Matrix Agency.
Yeah. Which brings me to the point that I so rudely interrupted you on, Bill, and that is that the ISO 3166 list was generally compiled for the purpose of postal codes, so it seems like a real oddity that you would add UM with some islands in the Pacific and some in the Caribbean for the use by postal officers.
We just pulled the 3166 list. We did not add to it. We didn't recommend to it. At one point, because there were mining interests on the island, there was postal service to Baker Island.
Actually, if I could just clarify that a little bit, because that comes directly to our bit of magic from before the dawn of time. The ISO 3166 list was not the postal list. The postal list was actually ISO 3166 plus four other codes. And that's how we came to get in the route. But that's a side issue which I can talk about on another time. But 3166 was a United Nations list designed for those countries and territories for which statistics wanted to be collected separately. That was effectively the catch-all of raison d'etre.
Without wanting to get down to a level of detail, very briefly, yet.
The ISO list actually constitutes a couple of different lists, and they were merged into one. So it's difficult to say very what it is. I mean, that's to get on the list, I mean, it helps to be a UN member, but it's not really necessary, and there are some other interesting ways of doing that.
So we could all be right or all be wrong. Thank you.
The province of the 3166 list is, for the purposes of our discussion, immaterial. That it exists and it is used is material. And it's not... It doesn't exist at the behest of ICANN. It's done by another party.
Correct. We'll come to that at the very end of this discussion. But can I just remind everybody, too, if you are speaking, to use your name first to introduce yourself.
Okay. So, again, this is Mr. Manning, and I will resume from after they stopped extracting guano from Baker Island. So the country code existed. There were, from the time of its inception in 1992 to about 1998, there was exactly one entry under .um. I was the administrator of that domain at that point. And it was basically a placeholder. There wasn't a whole lot going on there. There were some discussions that occurred about 5 years later, 2003, 2004, with some folks in the ICANN's were at that point in time ICANN contractors, and said, well, if we've got this TLD, is there any interest? And so we started checking around, and we actually created a corporate holding body for it, talked to the USC legal folks who agreed that we could extract this TLD from ISI and put it under a company framework called USMIR for the U.S. Minor Outlying Islands Registry, and then we started talking with some folks. And we ended up with a dozen registries and about 400 entries just by word of mouth. 2007 came around, and there were some questions raised about, did the U.S. government actually think this was a reasonable thing to do, was to basically monetize this TLD. Doing some homework, we went and discovered that the U.S. Minor Outlying Islands administration had been moved to the Department of Interior. The Department of Interior essentially was silent after repeated attempts, including letters to congressmen, our congresspeople, and the secretary and undersecretaries of the Department of Interior. We got nothing. But that stirred some interest in other parties, other parts of the U.S. government, including NTIA. NTIA decided that they were the responsible party, and they contacted some folks at USC, not the legal department, not the existing UM administrator, somebody who had no DNS or operations experience at all. And the person said, I have no idea what's going on here. And so, on May 2nd, 2008, I got this letter from the Department of Commerce. It says, Dear Mr. Manning, NTIA is in receipt of your April 22, 2008 letter, which you claim to be the operator of the .um country code top-level domain, and protest the return of the domain to unassigned status. NTIA has seen no evidence to substantiate your claim. To the contrary, the information that has been provided to NTIA supports the decision to return .um to unassigned status. The TLD is associated with the U.S. Minor Outlying Islands, Baker, Howland, Jarvis, Johnson Atoll, Kingman Reef, Midway Island, Palmyra Atoll, Wake Island, and Navassa Island, which are part of the Pacific Island, remote islands under the jurisdiction of the United States government. As such, UM CCTLD is a U.S. government asset. So they claim asset. Since December 4, 1997, University of Southern California's ISI, on behalf of the U.S. government, has acted as administrator for .um. On October 3rd, 2006, ICANN received correspondence from USC ISI indicating they no longer wish to perform the administrator function for the UMTLD. As of this correspondence, USC indicated there were no subdelegations for the UMTLD. On January 16th, during a special meeting of the ICANN Board of Directors, the board resolved, there's a resolution that the delegation of UM of the TLB be removed from the DNS route and it be returned to unassigned status. And there's a link to the publicly available minutes. So what occurred was that an uninformed party at USCISI basically told NTIA, I don't know what this is. There's nothing here. Take it away. When, in fact, if you look at the registration database, we have a couple of hundred entries in the database. We have still two active registrars that will take .um registrations. And I've been the registrar since its inception. That's pretty much the history of it. So at some point, a department of the U.S. government decided to assert control, even though it was its Department of Interior's responsibility. Commerce decided that they were going to take charge, and they instructed ICANN's board to move it to unassigned status, which the board did.
Yep, which is quite an interesting move from our perspective, because it was an undelegation, we think, rather than a retirement. So I think we've referred to it consistently on the way through, Bernie, as an undelegation, haven't we?
Yep.
And And there is no category for that. There is nothing in RFC 1591 or the GAC principles on delegations and redelegations that refers to just removing something from the route. It's conceptually interesting to us from that perspective, but it sounds to me like the US government in its control of one of its territories has gone through some machinations. You could hardly say that's a political interference in the sense of some other sovereign right.
Well, actually, this relates back to my earlier point about the government of China and who gets to speak for .cn. There were several different independent parts of the Chinese government which claimed authority over CN. And we have one department of the U.S. government, the Department of Interior, which is ostensibly responsible for these islands and their activities. And the U.S. Department of Commerce has decided that it gets to speak on that behalf without Interior giving them that right. So we actually there's a conflict inside, you know, who actually speaks for this set of activities. And Becky wants to say something.
Well, actually, Nigel was first. Okay.
I'm just really puzzled about this. Is Becky Burke? I'm really puzzled about the assertion that it's a U.S. asset. It doesn't seem to me that there's any basis in U.S. law for claiming that a top-level domain is a U.S. asset. The U.S. government happens to have controlled .us all along, but...
Good question. Would you like to help me take that back up formally?
Well, I'm definitely interested in knowing more about this.
Do you have, was that a quote directly from the letter where you said it was an asset?
That's on NTIA letterhead.
Nigel and then Patricia.
Okay, two things. Like Becky, I'm equally interested in the legal theory behind the delegation and redelegation of TLDs. Two things spring to mind. I'll take them in reverse order because the first one's shorter. Listening to the letter and listening to what you said about the relationship of the Department of the Interior to effective control of the territory within the U.S. government, it seems to me that there's a question of vires when it comes to the actions of another U.S. government department. It'd be a bit like the Department of Transport trying to assert something over one of the unoccupied islands near me. It seems a bit curious. The other thing is that we've persistently referred to .um as undelegation, perhaps because they both start with U, I don't know. I don't see any logical theory behind this. We have just completed, and perhaps because we haven't yet completed the work that we just completed, but we've just completed our work on revocation, done it very carefully, in excruciating detail over 18 months. And it seems to me that the only possible conclusion is that returning a domain to unassigned status, perhaps before delegating it again sometime in the future, or not, doesn't matter, can only fit into one category in what we've examined RFC 1591, and that's revocation.
Or perhaps it's a whole new category that isn't defined and therefore requires a PDP.
Keith, I think we said the other day that there weren't any other categories.
Well, we agreed that there aren't any other categories, but whether there is a need, as we know, retirement of a CCTLD, there have been some that have been retired, and we will be going through a PDP for that because there is no indication of previous policy on that point. Anyway, back to Bill, and then Patricio, then Stephen.
So, it's Bill Manning. 1591 came into existence after the TLDs were created. they were actually created and distributed. And then 1591 was kind of a document that came out after the fact that kind of said, oh, we should probably explain ourselves a little bit. It was never envisioned in the discussions that led up to 1591 that a country may choose to unassign its TLD and put it into unassigned status. But a country certainly can. I mean, I could see the UK government instructing Nominet to cease operations, and they were going to shut down the .UK name servers and stop taking registrations because they didn't want UK. I could see where the UK government might do something that unfathomable. And that movement to unassigned status was not contemplated in 1591, nor when we created things.
No, I think we're getting to a level of detail that we shouldn't be exploring. We in our delegation redelegation working group, we looked at some of the earlier RFCs and some of the earlier attempts to codify the delegation process. And you're right, we recognise that 1591 was after the majority of the delegations of the 246 CCTLDs. Anyway, we've got Patricio, then Stephen, then Martin.
Yeah, Patricio Bobledi here. I was going to ask if there had been an IANA report on this, but in the meantime I managed to find the report, so it is there. And it says that since there are no affected parties, there is little to consider making that decision.
Well, I think Bill is saying there are affected parties because there were registrations in the entered into the register. What I didn't quite get clarity on, though, Bill, was whether the register was actually serving and resolving names.
The registries and the registrars were active. You could get resolution of .um registrations. What IANA failed to do, or apparently they failed to do, was to actually look to see what was being resolved, what was being delegated. They simply took the NTIA letter at face value that there was nothing there and acted as if it was empty.
So a government was either not being truthful or didn't know, but asserted something, and IANA took that at face value. Ma'am, would you like to comment on that, Kim?
I think on that, my name is Kim Davies, and I work in the IANA department. all the activity that happened on .um was as a result of discussions with the University of Southern California. They were the sponsoring organization at the time. We had dialogue with them, if memory serves. The .um delegation was lame for an extended period. Name servers weren't working. We kept getting complaints. Our monitoring system kept notifying us that .um was not working. We were in the same building, so we reached out to several people we knew there. In the end, the head of USC wrote us a letter advising us that USC does not intend to operate this domain any further, that the domain is not in use, that there's no registrations in this domain, and therefore they requested that we remove it from the root zone. So, you know, in the context of what we're doing, we didn't go to NTIA until the authorization phase of this request. I can check the records going back. It's been a while. But, you know, in general, that's my recollection that, you know, USC managed this process. It wasn't – IANA didn't take action as the result of NTIA coming to us asking us to do something.
So Keith, I will concur that that's probably exactly what happened, but the head of USC had no clue what was going on three levels below in his organization, and he didn't ask.
Okay, thank you. So I've got Stephen, then Martin, then Eberhard.
Stephen Deerhake.as, my apologies for tardiness. Outline.
And your name is?
Stephen Deerhake.
Thank you. Apologies for being late. Outlying conference rooms are hard to find. I want to go back to an earlier point. I would like to state for the record that AS, and I probably can speak for Dottie, who should be here shortly, finds that the notion that a territory country code of the United States, such as ASVIPR, et cetera, is a, quote, USG asset, unquote, most curious. And we would dispute that.
Thanks, Stephen. Matt.
Thanks. It was what sparked my...
And your name?
Sorry, martinboyle.uk. What sparked my interest was Bill's reference to the concept of undelegation versus retirement. Now, the UK, not nominate, but the UK, has in fact two top-level domains, .gb, which is the entry officially in the ISO list, and .uk, which for political reasons is by far the preferred reference for the UK. Now, .gb is still in use, sitting in Ministry of Defence, but I'd always in the past assumed that if you if the government were to decide it no longer needed .gb, then it might retire it. But in fact, from what Bill has just said, it would seem to me that the UK government would have to make a specific decision to undelegate it. Now, this one's a much easier one because, in fact, it is, the delegation is owned by the UK government. It's a Ministry of Defence operated application that uses it. But I just thought I would raise that to make sure that other people would see that as being the right process, as it would be an undelegation, i.e. revocation of, rather than being a retirement issue. No, I'm actually asking for an understanding of whether in this particular case you are not talking about the retirement of a code, but actually a revocation, that the UK government would ask to revocate that and then leave it unassigned, because that then seems to me to be quite an interesting concept of, you know, here is a code that is still in the list and is still in use.
It's very interesting and something that we should maybe dedicate some time at some point to teasing out a little further as an academic exercise.
No, it's more than an academic exercise. The reason I'm raising it is that when at some stage we start going through a PDP for retirement, then we actually need to be very clear in our own mind what we mean by retirement. And rather naively up to now, I have thought that if in the remote chance UK government were to decide that it would separate itself from .gb, it would do it by revocation, not by retirement.
Sure. The undelegation is a technical term only.
Sorry. Yep, sorry. no, well, Eberhard is next, but I've got you now recorded on the speaking list, Nigel. I think when I used the word academic exercise for this group, if it were to entertain it, it is an academic exercise. It is beyond the scope of this working group to consider that. However, it does raise all sorts of interesting asides. So the speaking list is firstly Eberhard, then Nigel, and then I think we need to draw a line under this and carry on with the work. Eberhard.
Listen, I just looked up. GB is a reserved domain, and it is administered by the JNT Association trading as JNet in Oxfordshire, in Lumenhaus. And then I find it really difficult to understand how IANA cannot find out who is running IUM when I, from around the world, take one email to figure out from the IANA database who to talk to when I want to register Imodium. I really must say I find this difficult to understand.
I don't feel we had difficulty contacting the responsible party for .um. We were speaking with a sponsoring organization, speaking with various staff that worked within the sponsoring organization, spoke to those that were managing the zone at the time within that organization. Well, that, you know, that represented on behalf of ISI that they were. You know, if there's a dispute within that organization, that's not necessarily something that we get involved inside the internal dynamics inside a sponsoring organization. But they made communications to us.
Okay, I think we're getting to a level of detail that we probably shouldn't be visiting. I'll get back to the original order, so Nigel and then Everhart.
Well, my original comment is that, again, perhaps this is a good thing for saying that we should be doing our glossary pretty quick, but when Bill and I talk about undelegation, we talk about removing things from the root rather than the legal or quasi-legal concept of revoking a domain name. So when we come to retirement, I think we've got something to discuss. We've already got our first discussion point. But listening to Kim, to some extent, defend what went on, and this is not the forum for that, I keep hearing this expression, sponsoring organization. It really annoys me because there's no definition of it. It's a term that ICANN adopted unilaterally, applied to CCTLDs without any definition of what a sponsoring organization is or how it differs from the from the words that were used in RFC 1591. This appears nowhere in RFC 1591. People keep talking about sponsoring the domain as if we're selling soap powder, and I wish we'd stop it.
I think we have already gained some clarity that IANA is very willing to change from their use of sponsoring organisation. They just, they're waiting for us to provide them with the term that we want to see them use. So it's now in our hands, not theirs. Everhart.
Right, listen, I'm just mainly doing this so that it's recorded nicely in the transcript. This way of dealing with CCTLDs by IANA, function operator, or ICANN, is just the very reason why this working group came to fruition. This is not meant to attack you or anyone. I really still don't understand why, if somebody wants to register with UM, it takes 2 minutes to get hold of the guy. And if somebody wants to undelegate or whatever the whole CCTLD, it's difficult to reach the guy when he's in the same building. The point I want to make is not that. The point is that we need to get a framework down so that in the future these things get done in a predictable manner.
Thank you. I think that probably brings us to the end of the session. So it's been quite a thought-provoking little piece of information, and was much more, I've entertained quite a bit more time than the 10 minutes we allotted on the agenda. But thanks, Bill, for just happening to be here and giving us some fuel for thought and getting our brains started this morning. And you're most welcome to stay for our deliberations if you so wish. Can we now move to the topic of the GAC and how we might work going forwards? And Frank, during the GAC meeting the other day, we discussed that we haven't quite fully resolved the SIP chapter. We now have completed our revocation chapter, and the GAC could choose to participate in the public consultation either individually or collectively, or await the outcome of the public consultation and have a final report. My thought is that perhaps the GAC would prefer to look at the framework, all three chapters, holistically, and provide us a new set of comments, taking into account any old comments that they feel are still unresolved, but as it applies to the entire framework rather than dealing it in the chapterized fashion. Can I firstly check that that's, or what you see might be most appropriate for the GAC? And the other question, Frank, I think, is whether or what process you'd like to see us follow. Is there a need for webinars or some teleconference or something for the GAC members going forward between now and Singapore to answer questions or have some debate around some issues and so on? So how can we get to Singapore with a strong degree of accord between the GAC and the CCNSA?
Yeah, thanks, Frank, for the record, Frank March, GAC. I think you're right. We did try to do this chapter by chapter, but the strong feedback from those segments of the GAC who had actually taken an interest in this work was that they preferred to see the whole report before they commented, so they could look at the thing as a whole. In terms of the likely feedback, I think it'll come from a narrow section of the GAC, and it's likely to focus on the significantly interested parties' issues around the role of government. It's unlikely to look at other issues in terms of the strict definitional discussions that this group has undertaken. I don't think, for example, that some of the issues that have been raised in the revocation paper around what is inappropriate action or significantly, I forget some of the terminology you're all familiar with it, though you've tried to spend a lot of time defining what misbehavior would be and so on. I doubt very much that the GAC is interested in that. I think that the work of this group is fine as far as that is concerned. So that's likely to be the focus. I think, Keith, something like a webinar would be helpful. Am I not speaking close enough into the mic? Okay. I think that... yes, I can even hear myself coming out of the speaker now. I think that that a webinar could be helpful. It would certainly give, if I can put it in these terms, give some members of the GAC no excuse for not knowing what's going on. But those people who are very interested in this, and obviously NTIA in particular, they would take a close interest, will read the paper very thoroughly, will be aware of all the issues, and will give good feedback. So I think that would be helpful. In terms of timing, Singapore would be... what's going on there? It would obviously be helpful from the point of view of this group. The GAC is coming out of its current preoccupations with the new GTLD program to some extent, and starting to look at other issues over the next few months. It still has some things to put to bed. Singapore, like this one, is likely to be a very busy, crowded agenda, but I think it's reasonable to expect that you can expect finalisation of a report on that sort of time frame.
Excellent. Frank, I think we're very happy to entertain the requirement of time that the GAC folks feel they need from either this working group or the kebab, Keith, Becky and Bernie, or whatever subset you want. But it's probably quite important to us in getting to designing the joint CCNSO GAC session to know how you know, roughly what sort of time requirement the GEC would like to spend on the topic and so on. So if we could, if you and I can start collaborating along the way as we get closer, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, thank you much again. Keith, I'm just wondering what would be the consequences if the GEC was unable to give this group an answer before London?
Well, I guess there's no but.
This is Bart. If you look at the charter of this working group, it is expressed, and that was the starting point, it is the recommendations of this working group need to be supported by both the GAC and the CCNSO. So, say, you need to have a fleshed out discussion on say, like SIP, and that needs to be included and or at least finalized, and then the full book on of the FOI needs to be supported by both the GAC and the CCNSO before it can be sent to the board. That's the ultimate end goal.
I mean, I think there was a sort of a commitment from the GAC to walk with us all the way through, and this has been a longer process than I anticipated. My preference is to try and wind up this working group in London, that it actually disbands at that point and the framework's in place, implemented and so on. So, you know, if we can look at how we can accomplish that rather than could it go beyond that point, you know, then maybe we can get to concluding it in London. Back to Frank then.
Obviously, Frank Machigan, I can't commit the GAC, but it does seem to me that London is an achievable endpoint. If we regard Singapore as being an opportunity for dealing with educational issues and for any outstanding questions that the members of the GAC have, and I think what we need to do is make it, frankly, pretty straightforward for people to find the material, read the material, feedback on the material. I have already undertaken to collate responses on behalf of the GAC, and I will reiterate that in the next coming out of this meeting. Point out the timeline and work with the chair to achieve that to the best of their ability. Frankly, I think that the issues I've described aside, I think the GAC will be pretty happy with the report because I think you've done a good job.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. I've got Nigel then Stephen. Nigel.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. I'm actually very comfortable with what I'm hearing about from the GAC, which is actually mostly should we say, trying to fit it into the way the GAC works, isn't it, really? The GAC, as I understand it, is a very diverse body, and it's quite large, and you've had a lot of other things on your mind, and we do understand that. And I can see that possibly that there are difficulties to be navigated in getting to where we all want to be. I mean, we've been working on this together, and I think, particularly in the early days, the GAC's been very helpful. In the last few meetings and so on, as I said, you admit you've been a bit distracted by the GTLD stuff. So even if we couldn't achieve our target, I certainly hope that that doesn't turn out to be the case. I'm not that upset. What I am kind of concerned about is something that's not really related to the GAC per se. It's related to the IANA and to ICANN specifically. It's very clear that what we've been doing is not writing new policy. We've been very careful to restrict ourselves to look at the sources of existing policy, to use Keith and the working to colour and gloss and interpret and so on. The true interpretation of something does not change because the ICANN board does or does not approve of it. It's my view that the ICANN board in particular cannot failed to take notice of what we've already written in making any future redelegation decision. We can't say we're going to carry on like we did with, I don't know, .um or whatever, because we haven't yet ratified the work of the GAC and the working and the CCNOs within the working group. It's out there. It's actually in public notice. It's on for public consultation. Maybe there are some little things where there's going to be a little tweaks that we haven't quite hit the mark, but I think we have. And so, you know, from the ICANN board should take notice of what we've done even now. It's persuasive even as it stands. And just because for technical reasons the GAC takes 3 months longer or 6 months longer to approve it and then another it's delayed up to be ratified by the ICANN board, I don't feel that the ICANN board should refuse to take notice of what we've done. And that's the point I want to make.
Thanks, Nigel. Any response, Ring? Any comments?
No, I completely agree with that. The only thing is that if it does go forward with full endorsement from the GAC, as the terms of reference this group require, then the board would be in peril if it ignored it. So it gives it that much more emphasis, which of course is the whole point. But I agree with Nigel. I mean, it's out there. It makes points. I think it's a good piece of work. If the board doesn't take notice of it now, then it would be very silly.
Okay. Nigel. So I've got Stephen in Eberhardt.
In the interest of getting the GAC up to speed on this, would it make sense at the Singapore meeting to perhaps make members of this working group available on the weekend preceding the opening of the meeting and be able to interact with the GAC, have some session scheduled? Because I know you guys have some weekend meetings before the formal start of the meeting. If we could maybe carve out a couple hours to help them get up to speed before that.
Very much. Again, slight misstatement there, Stephen. The GAC works Saturday and Sundays. It's full schedule as the first 2 days over that weekend. We then have a break on the Monday so that we can interact with other groups, and then we work on the Wednesday, and Tuesday and Wednesday. So it's 4 full days. But I'm certain that we could work in something. Two-hour mutual education session would probably be a very useful thing to schedule, a sort of forum environment. So there could be a question and answer free flow would be a very, very sensible thing to do. Whether doing it over the weekend, or say on the Saturday morning, or I think better, try and schedule it on the Monday, so that because that's the time that is set aside for that sort of interaction for the GAC.
I think leave that for us to coordinate on, but let's not get into the debate as to whether the GAC works or not anyway. Sorry, Frank. Have a hat.
Listen, I just wanted to mention the word is endorsed, like the GAC is supposed to endorse and not to approve. And also there is an option, if they don't endorse, we can still recommend with listing what was not endorsed, if they don't endorse a specific thing. But that, I don't think that's a big issue. I have a proposal. Why don't we do it so from 9 to 11 on Monday during the grand opening session?
Okay, leave the timetabling to Frank and I. Is there anything else in terms of the GAC? Do you perceive any need for a call between the Suzanne and yourself and perhaps the Kebab Cabal?
Yeah, actually, I think it could be valuable because to be quite straightforward about this, Suzanne is the one who reads these papers out of all of the members of the GAC. She's the one who reads the papers carefully, analyzes them in the light of her knowledge of particularly US government and NTIA thinking about the very issues we're talking about, has a knowledge of the history, whether she knows about the NTIA letter or not, I'm not sure, in the case of UN, But it sounds like that's a more complicated story than perhaps some of us understand. Yeah, I think that might be helpful because that could step out exactly what the issues are. Frankly, you have the feedback from the SIP chapter. That's unlikely to change very much. That's been pretty carefully thought through. We'll obviously revisit that. But revisiting that in that grouping with the cabal could help all of us, frankly. And then a strong recommendation from a group within the GAC to proceed is likely to achieve a GAC consensus fairly quickly after that. So, you know, I'm fairly optimistic this could happen. But I think an education session in Singapore would be really helpful because there will be some people coming in late to the GAC, unaware of the background, that could be brought up to speed through that process.
Okay, I think, well, I'd like to be working on perhaps doing a webinar or a teleconference or something prior to Singapore and in Singapore. But I think we should schedule a call for a smaller group and work our way through that. And if we can do that in this calendar year to get Suzanne and yourself, we'll find a time. So I think...
I just would like to note for the record that he just referred to the kebab as a cabal.
I don't think we're going to see kebab in the glossary. So, anyway, I think this probably takes us through the first hour of our work, so perhaps we should have a break for 20 minutes and should we deal with item 4 on the agenda first, which is feedback on the revocation paper? And Bernie, have we had any?
So just a few minutes ago.
Okay, so still nothing. Okay, so we'll come back to item 5 after a 20-minute break and start to have a look at some of the concepts of the glossary and terminology and so on. So. If everyone's happy, we'll adjourn and back at 10:25. Thank you all. Thank you. So FOI working group back in session, and I think before we head on to the first look at the glossary and so on, we thought we might have a bit of a look at a bit more to do with the GAC and the GAC principles, as was referenced during the joint GAC-CCNFO session. And Bernie, do you want to just have a bit of a discussion on that?
Yes, please. Thank you. I'd like to take advantage of it while we have Frank here in the context that the advice the response we got back from the GAC on the SIP stuff talked about really the main worry was that we didn't reference or use the GAC principles enough in the document, and that we probably will get a similar, if not exactly the same, response relative to revocation. I don't take that as a bad thing per se. I think it's a question of, if I try to be positive about this, just adjusting things so it makes sense. I've gone through, makes sense for both parties, I should say, right? So I've gone through the GAC principles in detail, and with the understanding that we refer to them as the GAC principles for some very specific reasons. And really, to a certain extent, on the topics we had defined in from the DRD days, there's really very little that matches up. It doesn't mean that, you know, the GAC principles aren't the GAC principles, but relative to the topics we were given I don't see a lot of dovetailing because there just isn't. I mean, if we take revocation, there's actually no mention of revocation anywhere in the GAC principles. And I don't think it's a question of trying to get around the GAC principles. I think it's more a question of RFC 1591. What we were given as a mandate was to look at how these things are done, and technically there's nothing. And I don't think we're going against subsidiarity as such. And the other point is that, you know, I think it's the third section of the introduction of the GAC principles that says, you know, it's non-binding unless everyone has agreed to it in country. So we're trying to walk our way through this, and I'm wondering if you might have some words for us, Frank, that can be recorded.
Can I just say that from the look on Frank's face, the second word was going to be off. And just for the record, can we note that Cheryl Langdonor has joined us? Welcome, Cheryl. And Don
Hollander.
Oh, Joel Dazzini from PH.
And there is another Oct-Canadian in the background, hovering in the background.
And the gentleman at the back.
I shall leave shortly.
So, Alan from CA. Becky, you wanted to have a word and then come back to Frank?
Well, maybe I'm going to bail Frank out.
In that case, Frank.
I had a long talk with the GAC representative from Australia, and I came away with a different impression. It sort of first came out as you don't refer to the GAC principles enough, but I think what was bothering him was that there was no clear statement about because this is about revocation, there was no clear statement that, you know, the ultimate public policy authority rests with the relevant government, and the relevant government under, you know, applying its own laws could come, you know, with a request to IANA for what he referred to as a redelegation, and the other part of it was the notion that it doesn't say that if they exercise their rights under applicable law in accordance with applicable law and get a court order that transferring it, that IANA would comply, and I think he wanted to sort of comply promptly with that. I was not hearing a general request for more references to the GAC principles, but to an acknowledgement that we assumed and didn't address that IANA would comply with a court order that was binding on IANA. And I think
that's not a job.
Yes, but we couldn't we just like drop a footnote that says that?
I don't think it's a job.
No, I agree.
Let's sort of tease that one out a little bit. But I think another issue for Australia is that they have the situation of the Commonwealth of Australia and some minor outlying territories that don't necessarily have governments where they act as government, and so how their authority will work under those. Oddities. So anyway, yeah, they probably have more interest in this than sovereign nations with what they assert as a single territory. So anyway, Frank.
Yes, Frank. For the transcript, Frank Murch. Yeah, of course, I wasn't party to this conversation, Vicky, but I agree with you that both of what you and Keith have said.
First of all, Australia is in a similar position to the US and perhaps the UK in that it has a number of outlying islands and territories. And I know that Peter's department have given a great deal of thought to this. They don't actually have a problem necessarily, but they're just trying to think things through in terms of legal responsibility and so on, as responsible government officials sometimes do. You're right. But it comes back to the point that I think the issue in our comments on the significantly interested parties was the role of governments and the impact the governments could have. And, of course, very, very rightly, the issue is pointing out that it is local. Issues need to be resolved locally. Now, locally means government and, of course, includes court orders and so on. So I'm sure I don't think there are any issues of principle here. There are issues of strong nuance, perhaps. And I would imagine that our feedback from the GAC to this group will be in that respect. And if we can have an open forum discussion set up in Singapore, a lot of those issues can be surfaced and probably quite easily resolved through a mechanism such as what you're suggesting. Because I don't think there is anything fundamental here. I think it is a matter of emphasis and impact.
And yeah, I think in our own work we've struggled with some of the terminology that, you know, some people suggest that, you know, we use the term local government, and I think in the New Zealand sense or the Australian sense, the local government means the council, you know, the city council or the town council. And so the idea that in New Zealand the Eka Tahuna town council could object to something that .nz is doing and seek a redelegation to themselves just is quite absurd, I would think. But, you know, there is this tendency for us to assume that government is a single, contiguous, autonomous body that makes single, rational decisions. And, of course, it isn't. It's a multitude of departments, and quite often those departments have debates or arguments across their ministries and so on. So I guess the reference to local law is the more appropriate thing because, you know, as a tenet of the discussion. So anyway, so I think we have some agreement that we're not too far out of sync, and we need probably, again, to be exploring this from an informational aspect, and maybe we need to work with Australia on some examples of, you know, what might go wrong or might work and how it would be applied.
Yeah, not only that, Frank Murch again, but I'm working very closely with the Australian, responsible Australian officials across a number of issues, and I'll undertake to add this to the list and also work with my US colleagues to try and give you a coherent set of feedback which can be used to facilitate that discussion, which might help both parties.
Thank you, Frank. Okay, I think, is there anything else on this aspect that you wanted to cover, Bernie?
I guess we can leave it there for now, but I think Frank's reference to how we can nuance this or integrate my mathematical mind is, how can we insert somewhere in the work we've done the clarity the GAC is looking for, that we're not saying the GAC cannot run according to its principles. Our work is slightly orthogonal to that, because I think to a certain extent we do not believe that we are qualified to do things relative to the GAC principles. We did look and, you know, I've analyzed this thing in detail, but there were just no things that really crossed over and fit into what we were trying to do, and therefore we've come up with our things, which hopefully will help for a certain part of the problem. And I don't think that anyone has a problem with the rule of law applying as a basis for things. And if we can come to some sort of understanding that that is the case, then hopefully we can come to something that is agreeable to everyone.
Yeah, I completely agree, Bernie. Plain fact of the matter is the GAC principles are principles. RFC 1591, which this group has looked at very carefully and analyzed carefully in terms of the practice and so on, in various, you know, the collective experience of this group, are really at different levels. The principles are high-level principles. You've been dealing with quite difficult definition of terminology, and we're going to be doing a bit more of that today. And frankly, that's not where the GAC is at. You know, the GAC wants to make sure that governments have an appropriate authority at an appropriate level. So, you know, it comes back to what I was saying, is that probably we're not going to go too much further than the comments that came back in response to significantly interested parties. But it would be really helpful if there's a wider understanding of the work of this group, the fact that you are focused on not making policy, but perhaps isolating areas where new policy is necessary. And that would be helpful because it's an interpretation of history. What has happened, why it has happened, well, not so much why it has happened, but what has happened, and in a strictly operational sense. And frankly, that's probably a level below where the GAC really wants to focus.
Okay, thanks, Frank. Anything else on the topic before we move on? I think, we could move into item 5 on the agenda, which is the terminology or glossary chapter. I mistakenly wrote that we had previously agreed on the terminology, and of course we haven't. I'm just wondering if everybody had a chance to read this, because it was circulated very late, as in on Monday, and I'm wondering if it is fair for us to actually entertain debate on this, or perhaps rather than having Bernie walk us through it on the assumption that we've all read and absorbed it, that maybe we just open up the table for any input that anyone has to say something's drastically wrong or they dislike it, or whether we just leave it. My fear here is that I'm proposing that we don't meet again till January as a working group. So if we start to get into any detail on this today, we will have forgotten it all by then. So is it appropriate to really start today, or could we just make some general observations about it that we can take away and charge Bernie with working on so he can't take time off at Christmas? Nigel, and then Bernie.
Well, generally, I support what you just said. Would it not be possible to do both? We don't start our usual dissection here and now, but we encourage a robust and lively email debate over the coming weeks between now and our next telephone conference.
So the idea that Bernie could slice and dice the document and deal with some topics that he believes might be more controversial, and we take them on the list, that sounds like a reasonable way. Bernie?
Yeah, I sort of like that, because in fact this document is over a year old. I just pulled it up when we finished some stuff, and I'd really like the chance to go over it, especially considering we've published revocation, so that I can pull the relevant parts and put it all together, and we've got something that's up to date so that we can look at it.
Thanks, Bernie. Well, it's occurring to me that we're all in accord, and so unless anyone wants the floor in order to raise any issues from this document, I propose that we leave it at that and move on to item 6 on the agenda, other business. We've already covered off the revocation topic is due to the open consultation on that is due to finish at the end of December, so we'll await that. So looking at our schedule, I've suggested we have 4 meetings before Singapore, starting on January the 23rd and circulating every 2 weeks after that through to February the 6th. That seems to be relatively unoccupied times in terms of any other global meetings, March 6th, sorry. So if everyone's happy with that as a contemplated timetable, and there's likely to be some additional intersessional meetings with the GAC and so on. Other than that, does anyone have anything else to raise in terms of any other business? If not, I'll close the meeting and give you 1.25 hours of your lives back.
Yes.
Thank you.
Very much in your debt. Thank you.
Oh, the debt can be repaid in the bar.
Cheryl, since you came late, don't trip on yourself on the way out.
So thank you all for your participation, and we'll talk to you on January the 23rd, if not before. Thank you, and declare the meeting closed.